This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Just taking a couple of minutes here during the evening edition of Ozarks at Large to remind you that this is the spring fundraiser. It's a little calmer now in the building, in the Carver Center for Public Radio, than it is during the hours previous to the evening edition of Ozarks, because we've sent everybody home. Almost everybody.
Well, just about.
We're still here.
Everybody
but
us. But we're not answering volunteers' phone calls. I mean,
we're not
listeners.
Ignoring them.
Right, no.
we don't have our phone volunteers here after 7 o'clock. But we do know you're listening, and we do know you appreciate KUAF, and we do have a way for you to contribute to KUAF, even though we don't have phone volunteers.
Yes, you can log on to supportkuaf.com to make your contribution there on our secure, safe website.
It's as simple as that. You determine the amount. If you've never given before and perhaps you're a little bit baffled about what to give, mm-hmm. we have some suggestions.
We do. Sometimes we tell people if you think that KUAF is worth, say, a buck a day, maybe try $52. Or if you think it's worth a dollar a day, then it's $365. If you want to be a member of our NPR society, you can give $1,000 or more. It is whatever your budget allows you to do and whatever amount of time you spend listening to KUAF allow that to kind of be your judge. I will say that our average pledge is about $104.
So about $104, right.
So about $2 a week.
Right. And rest assured that if you think KUAF is worth more than you can afford, if you think, yeah, it is worth a dollar a day or something, but you can't afford that, that's okay.
Yeah.
Because throw in your budget into consideration as well.
Absolutely. The fact that you. The fact that you give it all is huge. Like,
right.
I think we talk about the inertia of not giving, I guess, you know, that you just sort of get in this habit that you don't give because, well, you've been listening and you just didn't find the time, or maybe you do it later and then you run out of time and then you don't do it.
Or somebody else is doing it.
Or somebody else is doing it for you. And so you just don't do that. So the fact that you make the choice to give and then, you know, log on to supportkuf.com and make that there is huge. That is a huge step. And we are very appreciative of all of our listeners who do that.
And you can do it right now online
at supportkuaf.com.
And thank you. Theater Squared's 8th season has been its most ambitious yet, opening with the original play, The Spiritualist, recent Pulitzer and Tony-nominated plays, and an inventive production of A Christmas Carol. The last full production of the season opens tomorrow, and it's a production that wraps up a stunning season appropriately, Hamlet. Grant Goodman makes his T2 debut as the title character, and Sean Patrick Riley, last seen here in the cast of T2's Good People this winter, is directing. Both gentlemen came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio during the first week of rehearsals to talk about the play, a work director Sean Patrick Riley says is in a class all of its own.
I think it's the greatest play in the English language, and I also think that Hamlet is the greatest role for an actor to play. And so when Bob Ford first approached me about directing this, last summer, I guess it was, my first question was, why? Why do Hamlet? And we had a discussion about that, and he brought up all these things. It's the greatest play ever written, and I agree. And this idea of that we were going to do it with 8 or 9 actors, and my response to him was, as a director, I don't know that I'm interested in directing Hamlet at T2. What I am interested in is T2 doing Hamlet, because there's a certain aesthetic that the theater has established that is about honesty and truth. And so when we began casting, one of the great things about being an actor who works a lot, and you know, I'm based out of New York, as you know, and the second that the word gets out that you're directing Hamlet, you hear from guys that you worked with 15 years ago.
Really?
Who are like, you're directing Hamlet. I'm in. You know, can I come read for you? I saw a lot of actors for this part, as you would. Grant came into the room. He read for us, and for me, it was a done deal. He gave a fantastic read. I have a very specific way of working with actors, even in a rehearsal. I mean, rather in an audition process, where I just want to sit down and have a conversation with the text. Just talk to me. Mm-hmm. And you were very amenable to that. And I knew before he left the room that he was my Hamlet. Absolutely. I was like, yeah, this is the guy. And was excited to start right away.
Did you have a good feeling?
I did. You know, one of the things I've been thinking just in the week that we've been working on this so far is that I'm terribly lucky to have such a symbiotic relationship with my director. Mm-hmm. And I knew that from the get-go. I knew that from the audition we had a very similar way of working, and that's proved to be true since we've begun rehearsals last week. I had a good feeling about it. I knew that we were on the same page. I could tell straight away that Sean was all about original, what we call original practices, which is sort of a way of performance that they think was the closest way to the way the plays were performed at the Globe in the day. And so him sitting down and interviewing me, which is a very British sort of tradition, and right. I wish that more American casting directors and directors would operate this way, which was, it was more of an interview. It was, right. And that's, you get to know the person. Well, you sit down and say,
and I believe we're
can
interviewing,
I work with that person?
Yeah, I believe we're interviewing each other mm-hmm. as well. One of the problems, I think, is, you know, the actor is the last person hired and the first person sort of dismissed in a lot of ways. And I feel as an actor that if I'm coming into a room to audition for you, yes, I'm here because I want a job. But also, do I want to spend the next X, you know, with a play, it can be, you know, if a play runs for a year, mm-hmm. you're going to spend a year with this person. But more specifically, do we agree on how this should be done? And I think that it's really important that the actor have that in mind, that it's getting the job is not why you walk into an audition. You walk into an audition because you have 5 minutes to do exactly what you were put on the planet to do, which is act. So come in and act. And then let me sit down with you as a director and say, hey, how is it that you work? Because so much of the actor-director relationship that often takes a lot of rehearsal time is, okay, this is how this person works. How are we going to work together? So in an audition, especially, you know, when Mr. Goodman came in, I could feel right away that we could forego that in rehearsal because, you know, not only this idea of approaching the play from the point of view of original practices or original acting practices, as they're sometimes called, but are you willing to roll with it here? And I think that's a lot of the reason that a director in an audition, a good director, I feel, in an audition, will throw something at you, not because that's the way they want you to play the part, but just to see whether or not you can take direction.
When you mention original practices,
right.
how is an original practice different than what might be a quote-unquote normal or more conventional rehearsal?
Right. It was started or really developed by there was a guy by the name of Sam Wanamaker who was a impresario and producer, and he and an actor director by the name of Marc Rolance, who is currently, I believe, still working in New York doing a rep of Twelfth Night and Richard III. Mark was the first artistic director of what's the Globe Theater in London. And they did a lot of research, as Grant was just saying, they did a lot of research to determine how is it that they actually did these plays. How is it that Romeo and Juliet in the prologue, is it the prologue or the epilogue?
Prologue.
The prologue says, this is the 2 hours traffic on our stage. And generally, and specifically in America, when you see Romeo and Juliet, it's 3.5-4 hours long. You go, well, what is this 2 hours traffic on our stage? So in doing all this research, they found that certain things had to be true, that there was no real set changes that you allowed the language to tell the story. Because part of the burden on the actor in a Shakespeare play is you're not only handling the dialogue, but you're also handling the lion's share of the narrative. This is where we are. This is what time of day it is. So that if we could strip away everything that's not necessary. So strip away the set dressing and say, you know what? If there's two goblets that are being used in this scene, we don't need six goblets. We need two. And it focuses and pares down so that the emphasis is on the actor and what they're saying. And to not impose something upon the play and upon the audience, but just say, this is the play. Let's hear it for the first time.
Let's talk about the soliloquy. When do you talk about it? Because arguably the most famous words originally written in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
Do you approach it any differently than you do the rest of the script?
No, I think that's the trap. I think that if you think of, oh, here comes the famous soliloquy, mm-hmm. then you're really ruined before you start. It has to be part of the through line of the play. It has to be part of the backwards and forwards of the play. I assume you're talking about to be or not to be.
I am, yes.
There's no escaping it, and I think that everyone knows in the room. I know Sean has an interesting story, and this is another blessing that I have, is Sean has played the role twice himself, and so that's a special gift for me to have his insight on that front. But I know that he has a funny story about coming out one night and saying to be.
Yeah, the first time I did the play, I was fortunate enough to work with the great director and teacher from the Royal Shakespeare Company, a gentleman by the name of John Barton. And he was always pushing me to drive the story forward. And he said to me one night, okay, I know you want to wallow. And I was young at the time, admittedly. He said, I know you want to wallow a bit more in to be or not to be. And I said, yeah, I think that he's really struggling with himself. When in fact, as an actor, I wanted to quote unquote perform that mm-hmm. very famous speech. And he said, all right, my dear, take the pause that you feel is in it. Because for me, it was not to be or not to be. That is the question, whether it is not. It was to be or not to be, you know, in that very
right.
Laurence Olivier clipped
right.
voice, to be or not to be. And he said, try it one night. And he said, see what happens. So I got out and took my spot. And I said, to be, and from the audience, or not to be. And I wound up pointing to the guy in the audience and saying, that is the question. So, in approaching that particular speech and some other, there's a lot of really famous lines in this play. It has to be about the story. Where is Hamlet? I think that more than any other play, definitely more than any other play before, and perhaps since, Hamlet represents an absolute historic moment, not just in the theater or in literature, but for human beings, which is, it's truly the first time that someone's inner life is exposed publicly. And that particular speech, it's questions that we've all contemplated. Why are we here? What is the meaning of this? Is letting go, is death easier than life? And I believe that the conclusion of it is perhaps to live in difficult circumstance, facing insurmountable tasks is harder, and that's the choice I'm going to make. I'm going to take the hard road. I believe that's what Hamlet is saying.
You know, Harold Bloom, who's a great Shakespearean critic, talks about this play as being a very experimental play.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost Brechtian mm-hmm. in a way. And as I was preparing to play it, memorizing lines, etc., I realized that his very first line is an aside to the audience. So from the get-go, he sort of forms this bond with the audience that he will then continue to keep throughout the play. And I think that the opening of his soul to an audience, directly to an audience in this case, is what makes Hamlet Hamlet. I think we do a very poor job in the United States about training an audience, and I don't mean by being didactic and teaching them, but in original practices, it's very clear that the audience is part of the play from the very beginning, from the second they enter the theater, that they're in the same room as the actors. We're so steeped in America in fourth wall tradition. So I think that our Shakespeare in America sometimes suffers because of that. So we put up that fourth wall and we do, like Sean says, sort of wallow in these monologues as if they are to ourselves, as if they're private moments, and they're not. They're shared moments, and they are a soliciting. And I think that when I was doing a production of the Scottish play. We're not in a theater. I was doing a production of
Macbeth.
Yes. I was doing a production of Macbeth, and I was playing Macbeth, and I came out of the theater after the performance, and this lady stopped me on the street and said, she goes, I really loved the show. She said, it felt like you were looking right at me. And I said, well, it's because I was looking right at you, you know?
You were there.
You were there. And I think that sometimes that frightens an audience. Sometimes an audience doesn't know how to take that. But then I think they start leaning forward in their seats and they start to become a part of it. And I think that's what good theater should be.
And, of course, at Theater Squared, if someone's leaning in the front row and leaning forward,
they're almost on stage.
Yes. Yes, right
which
there.
Which is a great feeling.
Which I not only don't have a problem with, I encourage. The audience is central to this production.
They're the missing link.
And we will completely embrace that they are there, as opposed to, like Grant was just saying, this fourth wall aesthetic that I don't believe can in any way be imposed on a Shakespeare play. You know, as actors, particularly American actors, we are living in the shadow of Stanislavski and Lee Strasberg and Marlon Brando. And I think one thing that we forget is Stanislavski, in his desire to bring truth to the stage, was reacting to a very stylized 19th century acting. I don't believe that method actors, and I count myself as one, I am a method actor, I have a method of working, that is about telling the truth in the moment, that is about hitting your mark, looking the other fellow in the eye, and telling the truth. I don't believe that we have a ownership of that in method acting, in Stanislavski-based training, because I do not believe in any way that in the Elizabethan theater, they weren't telling the truth. They were telling the truth. They were including the audience in the hearing of the truth. And I think that that's what is... It may jar the audience here. We will be doing, not to give away too much about my production, but traditionally in the Elizabethan theater and embracing this in original practices, the play will begin with what we sometimes call lords and ladies or a promenade, that the actors will present themselves to the audience and then go to their places, and we will begin the play, so that we're constantly in mind that this is 9 actors performing this play, that it's not, you're not here, you're not watching us, we're in this private place where you have been invited in a very privileged way to witness our work. That's not what's happening. It's especially at the Theater Squared space, where it is so intimate, you are an absolute part of this story. Not just Mr. Goodman, but there's other actors in the play that have a side that will speak to the audience. Laertes will address the audience. Gertrude will address the audience. Ophelia will address the audience in her deepest moment of doubt and pain. She's going to turn to the audience.
Polonius, Claudius
are all dealing with the audience and saying, help me here. Help me out here. Do you understand this? And I believe the audience will, in their response, say, I understand it. You are in an impossible situation. Go on. Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Kyle. Always a pleasure.
Excerpts from a conversation with Grant Goodman and Sean Patrick Riley, the lead and director, respectively, for Theater Squared's production of Hamlet. The play opens at Nadine Baum Studios tomorrow night. You can find out more about Hamlet and Theater Squared at theater2.org. That's the number 2, theater2.org.